we get the hour underway by welcoming into the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, buddy.
What's going on with you today? I know the monument off limits. Where are you getting the much-needed exercise?
I'm getting my much-needed exercise in the mine, Kimball.
Oh, dear.
Big old jungle gym, yep, and I'm swinging around in there like Tarzan and doing my stuff, and then each day I go for a three-mile run. So I've gone for a three-mile run 11 days in a row now, I think. So I climbed the monument 16 days in a row, at least five times, and I get competitive while everyone else whines and hides behind the sofa. So I go out for my runs and get up at 5, do my work, run, come back, work, deal with bigots. Same thing every day. It's not a lot different than it usually is, actually, to be honest with you.
Right. It's just you don't have to wait as long for people to get out of your way.
Right. Yeah. Actually, I've seen quite a bit of people running outside, more so than usual. And it's funny. They all seem to have one thing in common. They're all very fit. And I think, maybe there's a correlation between, like, maintaining your health all of the time and being active and being robust of spirit and getting out there and living your life and just maintaining basic social protocols as you go about your runs, because nobody's near anyone or anything, but it speaks to being healthy, not just physically, but mentally, I think. I think that's, as I was waiting to come on your air, I'm looking at Facebook, and I'm just trying not to vomit all over myself, because I don't want to talk to you covered in vomit, and I just see these posts from people who have no perspective, who I actually think are so happy this is happening right now, because it allows them to grandstand all the live long day. I just thought, man, go for a run. Honestly, the mental health of people, Facebook is a cesspool. And I heard your ad, that ad before about I wouldn't hire a resume, I'd hire a person. No, I'd hire the resume at this point. Give me the piece of paper. So sorry, sponsor.
That's right. That was a network sponsor, so we don't care.
Oh, okay. Good. So I'm still on the side of, I'm still one of your confederates.
Right. You have Adam. You go ahead. Absolutely.
Okay.
We got a lot of ground to cover this week. You have a lot of things that we want to talk about. Let's start with the piece you did for TLS about a play written by a very young Orson Welles. And you said you're reluctant to maybe use that word prodigy, but an interesting piece that he wrote about abolitionist John Brown.
Prodigy is usually used by parents as a marketing term. And that's going to be the case with Orson Welles. It was certainly the case with Mozart. I remember when I was like 3 or 4 and I was writing these stories in my head thinking I am very different than everyone else. But my parents were not careerists on my behalf in that sense. So the term never fell to me. And that's always a term that I've been a little wary of. And Welles had it applied to him often. It was almost a form of wish fulfillment where the people in Welles' life seemed to think that if they said this term enough, he would be viewed as such. It would become this official party line gospel type of deal. He was a crafty guy, and he had what we used to call brass balls because he's a teenager, and he goes to Ireland, and he talks his way onto the stage. He's like, oh, yeah, he dons this cod Irish accent, and he talks his way onto the stage, and he comes back to Middle America because people don't think of Welles as being from Wisconsin. But he's from Wisconsin. Have you been to Wisconsin? I remember the first time I went to Wisconsin. We moved to Illinois, and I hated the Middle West. It was flat. The sun was right in your face. There was no ocean. People are like, well, there's a lake. I go to the lake. I'm like, okay, this isn't the same thing. I'm driving through Wisconsin, and it's just, this is pre-internet days. It's just hockey rinks stuffed with porn on the side of the road, cheese and fireworks. It was just this grim. I'm thinking the Sea Dog is not enjoying this part of the country. And so you hear Welles' transatlantic accent, but that's largely something he just developed on his own. It was befitting how he wanted to sound, how he heard language, how he wanted his language to be processed when other people heard it. So he writes this play with his mentor, and it's kind of about this. He was always for these social causes, but not in the kind of genuflecting way that we so often are now. It's about a slave revolt. But what makes it particularly notable, what I was writing about for the Times Literary Supplement, an English periodical, was the framing devices. You're going to see a lot of the same framing devices, like less than a decade later, it's not that far after, in Citizen Kane. So he had this proto-Kane vehicle that he'd ridden when he was like 16 years old. So he's like a year older than my little mentee, Emma, upstairs, which is pretty mind-boggling.
All right, let's move on from there and talk about a piece you've got in Jazz Times about McCoy Tyner. And I thought it was interesting, Colin, you said that for people who, like you, like me, who grew up initially exposed to rock and roll, that a nice point of entry is often the work of John Coltrane, and McCoy Tyner a big part of that ensemble.
It's a common point of entry. I'm not sure it's the most efficacious form of point of entry, but if you grew up on like rock and roll, you get into rock and roll, chances are if you were not like a teenager in the 70s, so you're coming of age with the Ramones and the Clash and Joy Division or whatever, but like you're either from the 40s and 50s or you're like kind of post-70s when you start listening to music. Like, and for me, it was in the 1990s. You often go back to the 1960s rock and roll scene. You go to Pink Floyd, The Doors, Hendrix, Beatles, Stones, Who, Kinks, Yardbirds, all that. And I think if you're listening to that kind of music, Mothers of Invention, you're going to first be directed towards the Coltrane. Because, like, if your parents, my parents didn't have any, but if your parents had, like, rock and roll records by those bands I just named, they're probably going to have some Miles Davis and some John Coltrane, too. There was, like, not so much sonic overlap, but, like, enough, okay, pop culture overlap, hipness overlap, that you'd have both. And McCoy Tyner was the pianist. He recently died. That's why I was writing this piece. He was the pianist for John Coltrane's great quartet, one of the greatest small group ensembles in the history of any kind of music making. And he was a maximalist. And we have pianists who are minimalists and we have maximalists. Like a minimalist would be, I'd say, Duke Ellington or Count Basie. A maximalist is somebody like Art Tatum. Or in rock and roll, to give you an example, would be Jerry Lee Lewis. But you don't get many maximalists as piano players who are complementary players. Normally, someone like Art Tatum, who I mentioned, he's out there doing his own crazy thing, and the band, if he even has a band, if he's not just doing it on his own, is thinking, well, this is problematic keeping up with this guy. Are we going to figure this out? But McCoy Tyner was a maximalist in service to John Coltrane's even greater maximalism. And what he did once the Coltrane band essentially disbanded is he stepped out on his own, and he made this album in 1967, The Real McCoy, which I wrote about, where he has Elvin Jones, the drummer from Coltrane's unit, and he has Joe Henderson on tenor saxophone replacing Train, and he has Ron Carter, who is the bassist for Miles Davis' second great quintet, the first one which actually had Train in it. So he steps out on his own, this sort of, not his maiden voyage, but his best solo album. And it shows you that Coltrane learned as much from this guy as a player as you would figure that McCoy Tyner and everyone else who's ever tried to play jazz since Coltrane learned from Coltrane.
And as you point out, though, and it's easy to get lost in the shadow of Coltrane, but he deserves props as a leader himself, not just as part of that quartet.
Exactly. I find that the further I go along, we're just very lazy with the tropes that get handed down to us, which we just say, okay, that's how it is. There are players that are more potent than John Coltrane. A lot of it's luck, a lot of it's timing, a lot of it's marketing, and then a lot of it is our indolence that we never go back. We've spoken on this show about Hank Mobley, who could certainly hang as a player with John Coltrane. And some of the things John Coltrane did where it's like, these albums would come out, and no matter what the guy does after a certain point, it's going to be written about favorably. And you can tell when someone is just BSing a review. You see it all the time in publishing. It's just platitudes. You could apply the same superlatives to Windex oftentimes, except it just happens to be an album. Now, it's not that Coltrane made many duds, because he didn't. But post-1965, he's kind of doing whatever he wants to do, and it's going to be acclaimed. And I think McCoy Tyner, as a leader, he wanted some sonic balance back. He wanted a kind of equilibrium that he had provided in the Coltrane unit, because when he was with the Coltrane unit near the end, there wasn't a lot for him to do. The volume was such that he was being drowned out by Elvin Jones's polyrhythms, Coltrane shrieking off and splitting notes and doing everything he did. And I think he wanted to bring it back to that kind of hard bop, but also with a free jazz aspect that really the Coltrane unit was best at when they were at their best.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, let's move from the world of jazz to early 60s television and an episode of The Rifleman called The Grasshopper, one that seems especially appropriate for these times.
Yes, and it came out 60 years ago this month, actually, the second season of The Rifleman. And it's really, it fascinates me, the little plays, the theater, really, of The Rifleman, right? Like, it's been hailed as the most mature Western. And as I go along and I watch these, I mean, I really love Bonanza as a kid. It was probably like a strange thing.
Me too.
For someone of my vintage to be like, there's no women folk allowed on the Ponderosa. No, you rein that in, little Joe, and oh, Big Hoss, you're so funny.
Why did Ben have a different mother for each of his three sons? That's the mystery.
Yeah, he was a player. And I remember I went up to my dad one time. I'm like, hey, I want you to call me Hoss. And I'm like, I think that would be pretty good for our relationship. So my dad turns to me and says, okay, Hoss, bleep. I'm like, oh, okay, this didn't exactly work out.
It was not my plan. No.
Yeah, this wasn't what I was looking for. But when you hear Micah Torrance, the sheriff on The Rifleman, and Lucas Boy, which what he calls is this fraternal relationship with the titular Rifleman, and there's this spiritual aspect without a heavy-handed religiosity, which I like, because you don't really have that in any other Western. And then you have the coolest sort of Reed cocking, right? That thing he does at the beginning of the episode. But anyway, this particular episode, The Grasshopper, Lucas is on a train, and he's on a train with his kid, and he recognizes someone on the train and tried to kill him once. And this guy has been nabbed by the law, and the sheriff is bringing this guy in to hang. And it's going to be an uncomfortable ride. And I always am interested in train-related cinema or television. A Hard Day's Night, for instance, right? It's like great train theater. Hitchcock did a lot of interesting things with trains. It's hard to work on a train. And I'm watching this episode a couple of years ago or whatever, and I'm just thinking to myself, like, man, this is really well shot for television, the way it's blocked, the camera angles they're getting. So I go and I look up the director, because it's artful, and it's Lewis Allen, the same guy who directed 1944's The Uninvited. The influx of talent into Hollywood in, like, the late 50s and 1960s is outrageous. So meanwhile, this is going on, and you have the train get stopped, because there's a plague, of course there's a plague, right, of grasshoppers. And they can't, like, get traction with the rail. And so the guy tries to escape. He's shot. Lucas has to save him with a tourniquet. And it's all in there in, like, whatever it is, 25 minutes. And it's this mini film, right? It's like this short story Western that's artfully rendered. And it's almost like a little MoMA art film that's populous. Fascinating.
Yeah, it really is a great show, and so far ahead of its time in so many ways. And yet, some of those Western tropes make it into The Rifleman, although not as much as in some other Westerns of the time period. And we chatted online about some of those. One of your favorites and one of mine as well is how what you order to drink might say a lot about you.
Yes. You can go. It's like you're on the wagon when you're just drinking like 37 beers a day. Like it's almost like it's Gatorade. It's not quite water.
Right.
It's just some electrolytes.
You want a drink? No, I'll just have a beer. Thank you.
Like in the morning.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And not just like, oh, no. You know that, like, kind of nebulous time? I remember this time back when I used to be a drinker where it was like, yep, it's 3 in the morning. It's like, oh, I really should go back to sleep. And it's like, ah. You know, you pop the Samuel Adams. It's like, it's still plenty dark out, right? So you get away with it. But in the Western, that's just like coffee. That's fine. You should do more of that. In fact, it's spirited. It's how you want to be. And also someone had mentioned on Twitter, Joe the Mason, he had mentioned when you go into a bar and you order a drink and then you sort of change your mind, like, ah, that shot of whiskey is not enough. Leave the bottle. This is an option.
Right.
Like, what? When you go out, of course, now to a restaurant and have a bottle of wine or something like that, I don't do that because I'm a pauper, but it's just the idea that, like, I mean, a bottle of Lafroy whiskey, for instance, is like $75. Of course, this was rot gut. This wouldn't have been,
yes.
This wouldn't have been from Isla or anything like that. But so many of the things, it's like every time in these films and these TV shows, when they're with a saloon girl, and it's kind of like a courtship, and like, I love that girl, and I hope she's been faithful to me. Like, dude, her job is fellatio. Like, we're just leaving that out. But the things that are implied, like Miss Kitty on Gunsmoke, she's running a brothel. You just see these people, like, in between sessions, as it were. And it's like they had to be this kind of way with the censors at the time. And what was that show on HBO where it's not that way?
Deadwood, right? Yeah. What are you saying, though, about Amanda Blake? Stop. I grew up with Gunsmoke. She was just in the hospitality industry, Colin.
It was called the hospitality industry. And she was like the de facto madame of the Long Branch. And that's how it... The reason it's so successful in the town, it like shuts down the other bars, is it because it has this added element to it. And I love those things about the Western. And I guess I like them even more now because they're just so whining free. I've always liked things like that. The thing that sort of motivates me as I go about my own life is like when someone's bushwhacked on the trail and they've done nothing wrong and they just take this bullet or their partner betrays them just because they want to make off with all the loot and they leave them to die. And you see that person on the ground like bleeding out but not quite. And you know, and then the person who actually did this learns later on, that person on the ground is going to be coming for them. They're never going to stop, and they're eventually going to show up one day in town. It might be 17 years later. And not just even the score, but take the other person out. I like that. I like that kind of way of handling things. It motivates me. It's how I think personally without, like, the six piece. But beyond that, metaphorically, that's how I think. I think people could do more and better with more Westerns in their life in the modern age.
Colin, you sent me and some other folks yesterday an absolute gut punch of a story you've been working on called 6 Feet Away. It is the perfect piece of writing for the times we live in. It was so powerful and so good. Is that going to be something that will be available to more people for them to read? Because I think, as I told you, everybody needs to read this right now.
I appreciate what you said yesterday, and I wanted to apologize to you about not saying anything back. It's a case of when I write something like that, and I know what it is, and I know, like you said, how powerful it is, and I know the millions of people would go for it, and I know it's not just a great piece of writing or art or entertainment. It's something that helps the world, and it helps the world now. It would help the world in however many years or decades or centuries from now, and I know I'm going to be stonewalled. I mean, what's going to happen if you put something like that in the Atlantic or the New Yorker? That's going to go over massively. It's a viral story that's going to go viral in a good way, not some cheap kind of gimmicky grandstanding way, but in an important way. And people are going to read it too, and they're going to be heartened about what they're going through, and they're going to have a different take on what they're experiencing right now in the world. And they're also going to think to themselves, my God, man, reading can be something that it hasn't been in a long time with what I've been seeing. And it's new, but some of these people are so against me that they would rather curtail their own business, their reputation, whatever it might be, to stop me from getting in that place with this story that we both know. Anyone who reads this story who knows, anyone who was on that email chain and saw this story would know, it's like Fitty, exactly what it would do. It wouldn't just be some piece of literary fiction that enters the world and disappears. This is the kind of art of humanity, of a revolution, of consequence. And it's also just a great, surprising story. And I hope to Christ it gets a chance and gets to get out there soon rather than like 17 years from now or whenever it is when I'm finally past these people.
Well, I hope so too, because it needs to get out there and people need to see it. Colin, we appreciate it as always, my friend. Thanks for making time for us. And we'll look forward to doing it again right here next week.
All right, stay tall in the saddle, people.
You as well.